We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Philip has just lost the respect of the Youth League football team he coaches. He was asked what New England should do in the draft, and his answer was objectively terrible. The Athletic just wrote a great article about this, but Philip doesn't have the Athletic or the respect of a boisterous group of 11-year-olds who once looked up to him. Learn from Philip's error, get the Athletic, and get the info you need to speak draft fluently.
Welcome to the Solid Verbal.
The Solid Verbal.
Come after me! I'm a man! I'm 40!
I've heard so many players say, well, I want to be happy. You want to be happy for a day? Eat a steak.
It's that woo woo!
And now, Dan and Ty.
Welcome back to the Solid Verbal, boys and girls. My name is Ty Hildebrand, joining me, as always, over there in beautiful Chicago, Illinois, the one, the only, Dan Rubenstein. Sir, how are you?
I'm good. It actually has been pretty beautiful. It's been sunny and in the 60s and 70s. We went over to the lake. It's hard for me to call it the beach, but we went over to the lake and little man stomped around a bunch.
Nice.
You know, did an Easter egg hunt, did all sorts of fun stuff outside. And I'm doing pretty good. I'm very excited for this show. With the draft ahead, I always get very annoyed at all the articles that come out that say, or the tweets, people saying, see, stars don't matter. This two-star got drafted number 8 overall, when obviously the math would indicate differently, that you're far more likely to be drafted and drafted highly if you are a blue chip athlete, just because there are fewer of them and the percentages are in your favor that way. But I like to know individual stories at the same time, why guys get passed over as, you know, high school recruits, and what is behind the tape and the numbers and the history of these guys as recruits. I'm fascinated by all of this because, as I'm sure Brandon will point out, if NFL GMs and scouts were in charge of vetting all actual important positions in life, we'd be living in a much better world. Yeah.
Well, they do their homework. They do their homework because it's an investment in their future, especially if you're picking high up in the draft. It really does have a domino effect. So we wanted to bring Brandon on. This is our like before they were stars kind of show, because Brandon's evaluated all these kids. Perhaps he can give us a little bit of insight into their college career as we saw it as fans, what he projects forward into their NFL career. It is the month of April now, and as we forge ahead, there's going to be a lot of talk in football circles about the NFL draft. That's just the way it is. Whether you're an NFL fan or not, there is a connection into college football. And this is something that I know you and I have seen over the last couple of years. I think increasingly so as the draft has become more prominent. But there are people, college football fans, who maybe don't have any bent towards the NFL, who like to follow along, like to look at mock drafts, like to enter pools, because there is that college football tie-in. Some of our favorite players moving on, getting to that next level. One of the questions I know we're going to ask him that you have for Brandon is, who are you rooting for? Like, just as a fan, as somebody who's graded these guys out, who are you rooting for?
He's been around them.
He's been around them.
All of them.
Who are you rooting for, just on a personal human level, to succeed at the next level more so than maybe some others, given your affiliation? So he definitely brings a unique insight that I don't think we've ever fully tapped into in all the years that we've been doing this show. We're going to bring him on here momentarily to talk about some of these prospects and the NFL draft. Don't forget, follow along on social media if you haven't already. Follow along the Solid Verbal on your podcasting app of choice. And wink, wink, nudge, nudge, going out to verballers.com. That is our Patreon. That's where we're doing some bonus stuff. We've got an off-topic Q&A show coming up pretty soon. I have to check the calendar exactly when that is, but that has been a big hit thus far in this year off season. Some of those off-topic shows that we've done. Always excited to do the next one with you.
Because we had talked about doing kids sports movies from the 90s. Is that a preference, or is kids game shows from the 90s?
Oh, like Nickelodeon era.
Like, you know, Nick Arcade and Legend of the Hidden Temple.
You know what? I desperately...
You can make an executive decision here. I don't know.
No, I want to take it in from the Verballerhood. Solidverball@gmail.com. Okay. Reach out on social or through Patreon. I desperately wanted to go on Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego? Desperately.
All the best.
Desperately.
I love that show so much.
Desperately.
And I can speak to it first person, too. Going on a game show as a kid. So
a couple game shows as a kid.
Two as a legitimate kid. Yeah.
Legitimate kid. Right. Okay.
Legitimate kid.
Brandon Huffman, national recruiting editor from 24/7 Sports. Stopping on by. Let's have a listen.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, what's your secret? Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
All right, Dan, joining us now, we have him on a couple times a year. Frankly, it's not enough. It's our friend Brandon Huffman from 24/7.
Ventura High School, Ty.
Ventura High School.
Yes.
Usually we bring you on, Brandon, to talk about all things recruiting. This show isn't too far of a departure from that, but obviously with the NFL draft coming up, there are a lot of names that you see in your mock drafts, some guys that maybe you aren't familiar with. And Dan and I had this concept, like, what were some of these guys like in high school, you know, before they were stars? What kind of, I don't know, foreshadowing is out there maybe that you saw that some of the others out there doing mock drafts didn't have access to? So we thought we'd bring you on here. Again, the month of April is like all about the NFL mock drafts, and clearly there's a tie-in with college football there as well. So we're excited to talk with you. How are you, though? Before we get any further, what are you doing with yourself in this here early part of April?
You know, it's a unique kind of year for me, as it is in a normal spring. There's a lot of camps, 7-on-7 tournaments, showcases to go to, but now I get the added bonus of having high school football games up and around the West Coast in California and Oregon and Washington. High school season's going on. So I've had about 3 weekends where I've went to 3 or 4. 1 weekend I went to 5 high school games over the span of 3 days, all while sandwiching in a trip to Arizona for the Under Armour camp. So it's kind of that unique blend of, you know, the fall and the spring all happening at once. But hey, it's good. I've waited a long time to watch high school football, and I'm finally getting that opportunity to do it.
So one thing I wanted to always ask you as it relates to NFL mock drafts, do people consult with you before putting their round by round things together? Or that's my point exactly. But I'm wondering, like, to what end do people hit you up and be like, yo, Brandon, what do we know about this guy?
To be completely frank with you, I will have talked to a number of NFL agents and mostly regional scouts, not necessarily the director of scouting, but a guy who may be the area scout for the, you know, an AFC Central team might reach out to me, or an area scout for the NFC East team might reach out to me, and mostly just learn about the player that they're looking for and what his background was like as a high school player. What was his, you know, what was not his entourage, but like, what was the company he kept? You know, what did his high school coaches think? What did you think of him as a high schooler? What were the people that were around him like? And I mean, when people say that NFL front offices do their homework on potential drafts or potential draft picks, they are lying. I mean, it is, if you're going to call a slappy like me who hasn't dealt with some of these guys in 5-6 years, you know, they really do want to make sure that no stone is left unturned. And I'll talk to a number of them after a pro day. You know, there's been a couple pro days I've gone to in years past, and I'll have an area scout come up to me and say, hey, here's my number, give me a call after. I want to talk about those 7 guys plus these 4 guys at this school. So it happens all the time, but it's mostly just kind of, hey, you knew them before they became a college prospect. What did you think of them then? What, you know, how were their parents? How were their coaches? How were their trainers? Blah, blah, blah. Just to give them any kind of insight that they think they can take back to the war room and make the right pick up.
The follow-up question then is, based on that advice that you've given out in the past, as you've seen some of these guys go on into the league and try to make their mark, how accurate do you feel your advice has been?
I think my advice is always accurate. The NFL GM is screwed up all the time.
Correct. Good answer. Good answer.
Thank you. Thank you. But you know, but I will say that it is the one time a year where when people say stars don't matter and this and that, and you know, this guy was a 2-star, and everybody likes to throw the passive aggressive tweets about, oh, well, J.J. Watt was a 2-star. Well, J.J. Watt was also a walk-on, and 115 schools missed out on him when he was a high schooler, and the same thing with Aaron Rodgers. General managers screw up the NFL draft all the time. I mean, I'm a Cleveland Browns fan. I watched it happen for about 37 straight years. And it's amazing how the mock draft analysts get a free pass, but the folks that are in charge of stars and ratings don't. When NFL GMs are screwing this thing up, I mean, some of these NFL GMs could screw up a glass of water. And so it's fascinating that all the intel that they have, all the information they have, they still can make bad decisions and bad drafting.
One of the fascinating things, because we do get those stories. We do get those stories where, you know, J.J. Watt was a 2-star tight end at Central Michigan and, you know, became what he became at Wisconsin when he moved over to defense. And usually there's context to why a recruit is rated the way they are, be it like they have a very late weight gain, or they shoot up, their growth spurt happens super late in high school or junior college, or they're hurt this year. What is the percentage of time that you would say you and the 24/7, whatever ESPN Rivals community just full on flat out miss on a guy? And how much of it is like circumstantial? Like, we didn't think he would qualify. He was 5'7 as a junior, and then he was 6'2 as a senior. Like, how much is explained away with easy context?
I mean, I would say that more and more we're becoming much more accurate. We're having much better hits in what we're seeing as high schoolers and then projecting 3 or 4 years down the line. But you're going to have guys that slip through the cracks. You're going to have situations, you know, and I've talked about this one over the last year. You know, Justin Herbert is a great example. Mm-hmm. You know, when I was on leave his senior year in high school, dealing with my daughter's illness, so I never got to see him play his senior year. And, you know, some of the biggest L's that I took in rankings happened in that 2016 recruiting class with Taylor Rapp, with Justin Herbert, with, you know, guys like Evan Weaver. I mean, you know, mm-hmm. there's situations like that. They, you just don't get eyes on these guys. You don't see him at anything. In the case of Herbert, you know, he broke his leg as a junior. He didn't do a lot of camps. He didn't do 7-on-7. So it was just kind of one of those, he was out of sight, out of mind. And then nobody had a chance to see him play his senior year at Sheldon High School. And, you know, 4 years later, he ends up a top 5 pick and an NFL Rookie of the Year. And all anybody wanted to talk about out West that year was Jacob Eason. So right. There are still cases like that that slip through the cracks. And then even the big schools will land guys that nobody's heard of, or they'll land a guy like a Mac Jones, who was essentially a throw-in, a guy who bet on himself, realizing, hey, I'm going there at the same time Tua is, and I could go to Kentucky and everything will be great. And you still don't think the kid's going to see the field, and now he's a potential first-round pick. I mean, even the big schools have those guys that kind of surprise everybody, including the school that landed him.
So who are the big crack slippers, for lack of a better term, in this year's draft? When you look at the guys projected to go the first night or the first couple days, who are those guys where you're like, not nobody could see this coming, because a college coach and a college program or programs obviously saw something coming, saw some sort of glimmer, but who seems to be the furthest away from the recruiting community's radar that is now considered a blue chip NFL prospect?
I mean, Zach Wilson, there's probably no better player here. You can make a case too that, you know, there's a guy like Trey Lance, who I think has now probably cemented the fact that every North Dakota State quarterback moving forward will end up being rated highly because of him, because of, what's our guy in Philadelphia's name? Carson Wentz.
Carson Wentz, he's Indiana, yeah.
Yeah, so there may be, you know, a closer look given a North Dakota State quarterback, but, you know, it's not like Zach Wilson was a no-namer. At the time, he was committed to Boise State, and he ended up flipping to BYU late, wanted to go to Utah, and I mean, think about Utah for a second. His dad and mom both went to Utah. The kid dreamed of playing for Utah, and Utah went all in on Jack Tuttle. Meanwhile, Zach Wilson ends up at Boise State. Cal decides to bring in J.T. Shrout over him, and J.T. Shrout ends up decommitting going to Tennessee. In fact, I ran into Zach Wilson's dad last weekend at the Under Armour camp in Phoenix, and we had a good laugh. And by saying we, I mean he had a good laugh at how Zach's recruitment was so boring early on and how it's all turned out. It was the day after his pro day. And, you know, he's telling stories of Cal basically saying, hey, we got our quarterback. You don't need to bring him to camp. Boise State, them essentially driving to Boise to try to get seen by the coaches. And then BYU gives a late offer to Zach Wilson, and the rest is history. You know, he was a mid to solid three-star type guy, wasn't the biggest guy, wasn't the biggest arm. And I would say that because of what Zach Wilson did at BYU, and then you look at the season that Jackson Dart had at the same high school at Corner Canyon up in Draper, Utah, who, again, he too was a late bloomer, and he had the benefit of having a senior season when a lot of the West Coast teams weren't. He was the hottest quarterback recruit in the country by the fall. And part of that was because of look what Zach Wilson did at BYU. So there's nobody in this class. I mean, you look at the Trevor Lawrences, the Jamar Chases, the Penei Sewells, the Justin Fields, Micah Parsons, all those guys were consensus top 10, top 15, all American type guys. And then Zach Wilson's kind of the old Sesame Street. You know, one of these guys is not like the other.
One of the things, or maybe the thing that makes quarterback or projecting quarterback success as a high schooler to college and then college to the pros, is you only have one quarterback on the field at a time. So that means there's only opportunity for so many guys to prove themselves and to prove themselves in the right situation and to have injury luck and to, you know, have receiver injury luck, offensive line injury luck, a coordinator sticking around or having the right coordinator. There's so many different factors that go into the cocktail of quarterback success. And so it's understandable why that position is so difficult to evaluate. What is the next most difficult position? I mean, you mentioned Penei Sewell. He was a clear high blue chip elite recruit. And then it's Rashawn Slater at Northwestern, who I don't think anybody saw coming when you look at his offer list and the schools that he was down to. It was Northwestern and Illinois and Kansas and some G5 schools. Is it offensive line? Is there a different position that's hard, that's just as hard to project as quarterback? What position group stands out as just being kind of a crapshoot?
Yeah, I mean, I would say without question, it's offensive line. And it always has been, because where the danger starts to lie is that you see a guy who is dominant in high school and dominant maybe in college, but then doesn't necessarily have the projectable traits to the NFL. Then the flip side, you might see a guy who's 240 playing left tackle out of necessity for his high school team. He gets to college and now he's playing at 260, 270, 280. Then by the time the combine comes around, he's 290, but he's still moving like the 240-pound tight end he used to be. There's just so much development. It's funny, though, because if I look back at some of my best hits, they were offensive linemen. I look back, my biggest miss ever was a running back, and all three of those guys in the same draft class, or in the same recruiting class, it was the year when Darryl Scott, number one out west, and I actually had the lowest of any recruiting site, but he was the number one running back. But then 2 and 3 went Tyron Smith and Nat Khalil, who both ended up being the first tackle pick in consecutive drafts. So there's easy to kind of maybe see the elite guys, but you know, you have in recent years, there's been this real shift toward finding the guys that are a little bit on the thinner side as high schoolers that maybe aren't the no doubt, no brainers the day they get on campus, but they develop into that. And you know, you look at a case like a Mitch Hyatt. Mitch Hyatt started, what, 4 years at Clemson on 2 national championship teams and 3 that played in national championship games and probably some of the best offenses over the last decade and didn't get drafted. And, you know, he was the elite offensive lineman coming out of high school. But then you see that there's the other guys like the Rashawn Slaters that kind of just develop and they put on the good weight. And there's been some analytics done over the last few years. I think there was a 4-year gap in the NFL draft where not one offensive lineman was drafted in the first round who weighed over 300 pounds as a high schooler. And I mean, you think about offensive linemen, you look at the 300 plus pounders in high school, they look like they've got the bodies that are ready to withstand the collegiate grind. And now you're seeing this shift and more players are, you know, thinner as high schoolers and coaches want to put the good weight on them. They want to develop them in the size that they want. Then you got a guy like Penei Sewell, who's the opposite. It took Oregon taking the bad weight off of him, and now he's a potential top 2, top 3 pick.
So who are some names when you look back at their recruitment that you think it was a particularly fascinating trajectory that they had as recruits and as college players, now seeing the sort of end of their evaluation period as NFL draft prospects? What are the names that stand out that you'll always remember their recruitment and story?
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's a couple of guys I'm going to go kind of West Coast strong on this, but it makes sense. One was Wyatt David. And part of that was because, you know, Wyatt's older brother, David, played at Peninsula or Palos Verdes High School, was lightly recruited, played at Washington State, was at Cal. And I remember talking to his dad, and his dad said, hey, you've always been so helpful. If there's anything you can, you know, you ever need from me, let me know. And I said, well, I already know the answer to this question, but I'm asking anyway. Were you Alvin Mack in the program? And he said, haha, yeah, I used to do a little acting back in the day. And I'm like, you are the greatest college football player in the history of the cinema by far. Like, you will never find a more dominant college football player. He was Vontaze Burfict before there was Vontaze Burfict.
Mm-hmm. That's amazing.
And it was so funny. Well, then, you know, by the time Wyatt was a senior, he was so tired of that story that Wyatt started to say, dude, I would bury and pancake Alvin Mack every single play. Well, then you watch what Wyatt does at Ohio State, and you're like, you know what? He might have been right. He might have done exactly what 12th grade Wyatt Davis said. But, you know, the fun fact that people, very few people know about Wyatt Davis is that his grandfather is an NFL Hall of Famer. You know, we think about his dad being this college football star on the movies and all the different athletes he played. But, you know, he comes from a good bloodline in terms of an NFL Hall of Famer. So it's been fun to watch Wyatt kind of come into his own. I would say, you know, the one, and I tweeted about this a bunch during the season, it wasn't like the guy wasn't a known name. I mean, Devontae Smith was a 5-star coming out of high school. He was part of arguably the best 3-headed monster receiver class that, you know, college football has ever seen. And we'll see what this Ohio State class in the next couple of years turns out to be. But the Jerry Jeudy, Henry Ruggs, Devontae Smith, 3-headed monster was pretty impressive. And, you know, the last time we saw Devontae Smith as a high schooler, it was on a viral clip at the Army All-American Bowl. And it was an east-west scrimmage one day. And the one knock Devontae Smith still is dealing with right now is what?
Size.
He's skinny.
Skinny, yeah.
Okay, so, you know, that's been something he's been dealing with for 4 or 5 years. And Richard LeCount, who went to Georgia, basically drove him a good 25, 30 yards off the field. It was kind of like watching the blind side of Michael Ower drove the kid off the field. So this really happened, and it happened in a day and age where everybody had their cameras out. And the clip probably had over 1 million views. And what I remember the most vividly about the play is, in this day and age, a lot of kids would sulk. If they get did dirty, they'll go on Twitter, they'll get combative. Devontae Smith, we go down after the practice to talk and do some interviews, and he looks at John Garcia, who I worked with at the time, and he said, first thing he says, how bad is it? And John goes, it's pretty bad. He's like, is it viral yet? And John goes, it's really viral. And Devontae just goes, damn. And he laughs. He says, all right, let's do the interview. Like, he just took the loss. Well, yeah. A year later, Devontae Smith is going to torture Richard LeCount and his dreams for the rest of his life because he gets the walk-off touchdown to beat Georgia to win the national championship 3 years later as arguably, you know, the greatest season, if not one of the greatest careers ever for a collegiate receiver. And to think about, like, the last time we saw this guy as a high schooler was him getting thrown over the side of a bench on the sideline to winning a Heisman Trophy, winning a national championship. You know, it's been fun to watch because of the way he handled it. He handled it so graciously. So those are two guys that I've always kind of, and that 2017 class, you know, you also have Jalen Phillips and the roller coaster that his career.
You're stealing my thunder. That was my next question.
Yeah. I'll let you ask the question, but he's another one. That 2017 class is quite some stories that interesting recruitment, interesting roller coaster of a career that all kind of ended up still with the likelihood they're going to be gone on Thursday night.
So you bring up Jalen Phillips right now. I'm looking at one of the mock drafts. He's a first round pick, I think, according to, is this CBS? Yeah, CBS. They've got him going in the 20s, I think, to the Saints maybe. But Jalen Phillips, like you said, loaded class a few years back, I believe was a number one overall recruit per the 24/7 historical rankings. He's one of the top 50 best recruits of all time. So clearly a kid who came in with a lot of acclaim, but had a bit of a journey to get to this state, right? Signed with UCLA, eventually catches on with Miami, has a pretty good year. You know, I hate to ask the talk about question, but talk about Jalen Phillips and the journey that he's been on that brought him to where he's at now, where I guess he's realizing that full potential.
Yeah. You know, one of the most fascinating side notes about Jalen Phillips is I believe he is the only player in the 24/7 sports composite history who was not named the number one player by any of the media outlets that covered recruiting. And that's what's interesting is you look at the guys who've been the number one composite player in the years before, the years after, they were all ranked number one by at least one of the four at the time when Jalen Phillips was named the composite number one. There were four recruiting sites, Scouts, which is where I was at the time, 24/7, or I'm at now, ESPN and Rivals. And neither of those four sites had him as their number one player, but all four sites had him up high enough. And there was such a difference in who was ranked number one. I think Najee Harris was number one at Scout. I want to say Cam Akers might have been number one at ESPN. And so there was this wide kind of opinion on who the actual number one player was by all four sites. Again, Jalen Phillips ends up the number one composite player. So fast forward to him getting to UCLA. He starts in their season opener against Texas A&M. Has a couple of plays. I think he had a couple tackles for loss, a couple of hurries, and showed some flashes really early on that he was going to be a special player. Then I want to say about week three or four, he sprained his ankle and was never really the same. Jim Mora gets fired at the end of the year. Chip Kelly comes in. Jalen Phillips ends up having another injury that he suffers in, I want to say like a scooter kind of accident at UCLA that like destroys his wrist. He leaves UCLA on basically he was retiring from football. The talk at the time that he was retiring from football, may stay at UCLA, ultimately decided to pursue a career in music. Ended up at Miami and completely was revitalized in Manny Diaz's defense to the point where he's now going to be a first rounder, most likely. So yeah, he won't be the number one overall pick, but he's essentially a hit, a five-star going in the first round. And all it took was a change of scenery, you know, and I remember when he picked UCLA at the time, he seemed like a lock for Stanford. That was the spring of his junior year when his recruitment was picking up. Stanford was just coming off the Christian McCaffrey Rose Bowl win over Iowa. You know, they were once again the hot team out in the Pac-12. They had won, their third Pac-12 title in about 4 years at that point. He was a 4.0 student, and UCLA didn't beat Stanford for those kind of guys ever with Jim Mora and David Shaw. And Jalen Phillips decided pretty early on he wanted to go to UCLA for his dad went. So he was a legacy to some extent, but you know, for him to come around full circle after it looked like he was walking away from the game of football to then being the dominant player that we all saw in high school. This guy played tight end. He played linebacker. He split out wide, play receiver. He could play outside of the end. He could put his hand down, play a three sack. He played just about everywhere. I think he had like a 5 or 6 sack game at one point at Redlands East Valley. And now, you know, he ends up revitalizing under Manny Diaz and, you know, he's a success story, but it's not like he's a guy who outplayed his ranking. he more than I guess more than anything lived up to the ranking. It just took a hell of a journey to get there.
You know who the number? Well, I know you know the answer. The number two player in the 2017 class.
I want to say it was Najee Harris.
It was Najee Harris. Najee Harris also on our list here of guys to ask about, because look, he's obviously been a fixture. He's been a standout performer at Alabama. Was the number two overall recruit in that 2017 class. And weirdly, I don't know if it's because running backs often get devalued a bit as we go into the NFL draft. I don't know if it's because he played on just such a cast of all-stars at Alabama. I don't know what it is, but Najee Harris has fallen into like the second round here per some of these mock drafts. I don't feel like I've heard a lot of him over the last couple months, really not any of the running backs because so much has been focused on quarterbacks and wide receivers. But I remember talking to you shortly after Najee Harris was signed on at Alabama, and you were gung-ho on Najee, gung-ho on him. And it wasn't until last year, maybe this year, when we saw more of him that we got to see as college football fans that dynamic of having incredible moves and elusiveness with the power. And I guess maybe like the closest analog to an Alabama running back in the NFL having crazy success, at least currently, is someone like a Derrick Henry. This is a guy who's a different back. He's maybe not as powerful as Henry, but he probably has better moves.
And not only that, I think Najee Harris is one of the best pass-catching running backs that I've seen in the last 5 to 7 years. And that was something about him that I always really appreciated, is that when you're an elite player, when you're even an elite back, 7-on-7 is not necessarily a great avenue for inside linebackers and running backs to show what they do their best. You know, linebackers are the inside guys, are they're the ones that shut down running games. They're the ones that get into the backfield, and maybe they're not as good in pass coverage. With running backs, hey, I'm a guy that takes the handoff and runs over people, you know, but I'm not used to the ball being thrown to me. I'm used to being put in my breadbasket and then I run. But Najee did a ton of 7-on-7 just so he could improve as a pass catcher and really be a weapon as a receiver. But when you watched him run the ball, I mean, it was a treat. Guys just could not bring him down in the open field. I mean, if you were an elite open field tackler, he'd make you look like an average open field tackler, because he would either run over you, run around you, run through you, or might do a way of doing all three at the same time. And I was convinced early on. I mean, I think he might have been, when at the old scout.com rankings days, he might have been a wire-to-wire number one. When we saw him as a freshman, you could just tell he was special. And what I think kind of helped open the doors to why we thought he was going to be so elite is, you know, he was coming out, his freshman year was Joe Mixon's senior year. Joe Mixon was one of the top backs out west. Leonard Fournette was also in that class. And you looked at Najee, he was kind of a combination of Fournette and Mixon in terms of just the all-around game that he had. And then he goes and puts up video game numbers at a pretty high level in Northern California, commits early to Alabama. There were other schools that kept trying, but he doubled down and stuck with Alabama. Then, you know, his senior year, his junior year, is Derrick Henry's Heisman Trophy winning season. Then his senior year, he comes out and puts up more big numbers. And there was a big debate at that time. Who was better, him or Cam Akers? Even out west, who was better, him or Stephen Carr? And, you know, I think Cam Akers was criminally underused at Florida State. But I think Najee, his career played out exactly as he thought it was going to be. He knew going to Alabama that unless you were a Minka Fitzpatrick or even a Jonah Williams, there was a hard chance that it was going to be hard for a true freshman to come in and be the starter, especially with so many established players. And, you know, Josh Jacobs was there. I want to say Bo Scarborough may have come back for a year, or maybe he left before that. But there was, you know, a little bit of a glut of backs in Alabama's backfield. Damien Harris is there as well. And it just took him time. He stayed the course, and, you know, he's going to go down historically as one of the most productive backs in SEC history. But like you said, the running back position has been so devalued over the years that he may not be fully appreciated come the draft. He's probably going to be, you know, one of the top two or three back pick, but it might not be until day two. But I don't think that takes away from the fact that he was every bit the elite running back and the elite player we thought he would be. And I think Nick Saban got exactly what we thought. And hey, Derrick Henry went in the second round. I think there's a lot of NFL GMs that would have loved to have that one back.
It's a good transition because you mentioned both Najee Harris and before DeVonta Smith, guys who really have shown themselves to be impressive, not just on the field, but you hear them speak, you see their, you learn more about their stories. Najee Harris, I think, has become more outspoken these past few months, and Devontae Smith has certainly carried himself really impressively. Who are the guys at or near the top of the draft, just from interacting with them as humans, that you're rooting for because you firmly believe they have a strong head on their shoulders, and that, you know, if they end up in the right situation, that they're, you know, their maturity will shine through? With, it's a very difficult thing to be an NFL player sometimes. Who are you rooting for as humans that's being talked about at or near the top?
Yeah, I mean, this might be a little bit of a cop-out because he's going to be the number one pick in the draft unless something crazy right. happens. But, you know, the attention that was thrust on Trevor Lawrence, it wasn't one of those where, you know, he was the golden child, you know, at a young age like LeBron, where he's on the cover of magazines. But I mean, he was pretty quickly identified as the number one player in that class. And, you know, at Scout, we had him as our number one player. 24/7 did as well. There was a little bit of a dip after the opening where 24/7, who we hadn't merged with at the time, put Justin Fields at number one before ultimately setting on Trevor Lawrence. But I mean, between the long hair, the just kind of the sunshine, a label that he was given, but just right. the expectations of what Trevor Lawrence was able to do. And, you know, to really see what he became symbolic of college football over the last year and being so adamant about getting these guys to play. And Justin Fields, too. I mean, it's almost a cop-out to say those are the two that you really root for, but the reality is those two are going to be intertwined forever. And you look at what both those guys meant to the game of college football the last 2-3 years. And, you know, each of them played for a national championship, you know, won a national championship. They're both just the special players that they were 1-2. And, you know, there's a chance they can go 1-2 now, but it's more than what they did on the field. It's what they did off the field and the attention that they brought to the game and for their peers and for their teammates. Those are two guys you just really root for, and you know they're going to be successful because, yeah, like Kirk Herbstreit, I mean, the whispers, it happens every year. There's always some agent who goes rogue and tries to start, you know, knocking off one of the quarterbacks, or a scout does it. But the whispers about Justin Fields and the work ethic, that's not at all anything that I've ever heard coming out of high school, coming out of college, either of his collegiate stops. And, you know, Trevor Lawrence, too. I mean, just both those guys, they meant so much to the game. Those are guys that are easy to root for. And they're super talented players on top of it. And, you know, getting a chance to talk to Trevor Lawrence at the opening. I remember he, at the time when he had come to the opening finals, he had just committed to Clemson a couple of weeks before. And I just kind of did a sidebar interview. I was a guy who wasn't a familiar face because I was covering just the West at the time. And, you know, just talking to him, you realize the kid just loved football. He just wanted to be there. And he didn't care that he was the number one player. He didn't feel like he needed every rep and every throw. And he was fine sharing the duty on his 7-on-7 team. And even at that event, Justin Fields went just nuts. I mean, he was by far the best player at the opening that particular event and won the Elite 11, won the Nike 7-on. And, you know, both of them, they were competitors. But Trevor Lawrence wasn't the guy that said, I need to take every rep. Screw this other kid on my team. I don't even know who the other kid in the team was. But it was kind of like, hey, we both earned our spot here. We both should have the opportunity to play. And just, you know, you see things like that, and you realize that these guys are good teammates. These are guys you want to go to battle with. And I think both those guys are players that you really root for. I mean, I already talked about Devontae Smith, and just the way he handled the whole Richard LeCount thing always earned him bonus points. But I just think the expectations of what Justin Fields and Trevor Lawrence were supposed to do in college and what they were supposed to do now going to the NFL, you can't help but root for those guys.
I wanted to get your take. You mentioned Justin Fields. One of the bits of criticism that I've seen floating around now as we get closer to the draft is that he locks onto his primary receivers too much. I forget what the stat was and who did it. I'm probably botching this, but something like 70% of the time he is zeroed in on his primary receiver. And some have pointed out that they think that's important to note because you go to the NFL, you need to be better with your progressions. When someone like you hears that, how do you react to it?
You know, I think it's a classic case of what every scout deals with. You got to find something. You got to find a knock on everybody. Everybody, there's no perfect player. There's no perfect prospect. You have to find what their inability is or what their area of weakness is or what the area they need to improve is. And I think that's the one that he's been given. Unfortunately, that's not necessarily one you want to have a quarterback beginning. Maybe you want to say, oh, well, he takes too many risks. You know, maybe he throws a few too many interceptions because he's got such a strong arm that he tries to force things at times because, you know, that's the only speed he knows how to throw at. But the whole progression of things, I think that is something that ends up becoming a red flag for some people. But I think it's unfair. I think when you have a receiver like a Chris Olave or a Garrett Wilson at Ohio State, you lock into those primary receivers because you know you've got a mismatch on offense every single time. If I've got Chris Olave who's going to blow by every defensive back just about that he lines up against, I'm going to find him. Yes, maybe he is the primary receiver. You know, people didn't have a lot of those same knocks about Sam Darnold at USC being a guy that locked onto his primary receiver. When you look at USC's offense, going back to when Clay Helton was there, they always had one receiver who was kind of the guy who got the majority of the touches. And I think if you look at the Alabama and the LSUs of the last few years where you have 3, 4, 5 elite pass catchers and tight ends, then maybe Burrow and Tua aren't getting that as much because they're able to spread the field a little bit more. They have weapons. Ohio State's got a fantastic receiver room, but it was pretty top-heavy this year with Olave and with Garrett Wilson. They have a lot of really good young talent, but you know, Jackson Smith-Njigba, Julian Fleming, G. Scott Jr., none of those guys really emerged as true freshmen. You know, Jeremy Rucker didn't seem to get utilized much until the bowl game and until the national championship game. But a lot of it, it's not so much that he lost his primary receiver. It's, I've got the best receiver on the field. I've got a mismatch. I'm going for him, and I'm going to throw him open. I think that's something, you know, it's funny when I talk to some of the NFL scouts that I know that say that they think that that gets overplayed a lot, that it's something that some people are just looking for a reason. You know, and how are you determining the eyes when you're watching the all 22 from 500 feet away? Why, how are you able to determine who his eyes are on? I mean, the eyes aren't that crystal clear. It's one of those where it kind of becomes the every year we hear the buzzwords of the draft, the different, oh, I watched the tape. Tape's the one thing. It's like the fax machine at letter of intent. Nobody's watching tape anymore. Okay. We're all watching digital video, but it becomes the cool buzzword. And so that becomes the cool buzzword knock is, oh, he locks onto the sheet. Well, if you have mismatches, you're going to exploit them. And I think that's what he did more than anything is he found his primary receiver. And I watched enough of Justin Fields as a high schooler in the last couple of years at Ohio State to see when he needed to spread the field, he spread the field just fine. But when Chris Olave was blowing by DBs, that's who he locked into. And look at the success it brought him. It brought him 6 points almost every time.
Yeah, I mean, and that's the thing, right? Like, did he have to go to a different receiver or were the primary guys open?
It's also what he's asked to do too, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's funny you bring that up because I remember talking to a Pac-12 head coach one time and they were talking about the grading system that some media outlets will do the day after the game. And they'll say, oh, well, you know, he was the leading defensive end in the country because he graded out at a 98%. And the coaches are saying, when we did our internal grade, he rated out as like a 76%. He missed so many blocks or he missed, you know, this play and that. It's like they're just looking at the end result. We're looking down on what player assignment was. What was he? What did we ask him to do? What do we need him to do? What is he expected to do? And he did not do the play right at all. But the end result ended up being that he fell backwards onto a defensive end or, you know, the running back tripped and the looked like the outside linebacker made the tackle for loss in the backfield when he did everything wrong leading up to that play. It reminded me of, you know, a teammate in high school who had, I think, like 9 or 10 interceptions one year. And normally you have your coach lauding him and saying, man, that's a lot of interceptions. Our coach said, sweet, of your 9 interceptions, one time you actually did the right thing. And that's what people don't understand is what the coaches are asking and what the fans and the scouts are seeing often are vastly different.
One thing that you slipped into an earlier answer was that you had, I think it was Darrell Scott, the lowest ranked of any of the recruiting analysts or services when he was the number one running back. And I love that. I love throwing in your own personal take. So when you look at this year's class, is there a player? So this is this year's draft class. Is there a player that you remember, you know, standing on the table for saying, there's no way this guy is a three star. This guy is going to have a great career, that you can now say, I told you so, as he appears to be a, you know, a top 50, 60 prospect. Who is your I told you so from this year's class that maybe you didn't win that argument when you were evaluating?
Well, I ultimately won the argument, but it was kind of a risk at first. And this is one that I think you'll like, Dan. It's Javon Holland. You know, with Javon Holland at Scout, we were the first ones to make him a four-star. Everybody else had him as a three-star. He got invited to the opening finals, didn't get invited to the Army All-American Bowl, didn't get invited to the Under Armour All-American game, gets invited to the Polynesian Bowl, and he was probably our MVP throughout that whole weekend, because he was a player that, as a sophomore, as a junior, you know, he could have been a wide receiver at the next level. And it was actually about a 2-day event in Las Vegas that I saw him at the Adidas Regionals or Adidas National 7-on-7. He had a touchdown catch playing receiver. In fact, it was Carson Strong, who's now the quarterback in Nevada, was the quarterback for that team. And it took Javon about 4 strides to get himself open on this post for a touchdown. And it came a play after his team got the ball back where he was lined up on the right side of the field, went to go provide safety help to the left side, flipped his hips, did a clear sprint back to the left side of the field to pick off a pass in that same game. Then he comes out and he runs like a 45-yard post for a touchdown. And we already had him as a 4-star, but nobody else did. And I just kept thinking, like, I don't care what side of the ball this kid plays, this kid's going to be a special player in college. And he ended up starting, I want to say, started pretty quickly into his freshman year at Oregon. Obviously was a huge part of their Rose Bowl team as a sophomore. I didn't play this last year, but he was a player that I remember going early on and thinking that, you know, man, this kid's just a special football player. I just need to figure out what the heck he's going to play. I think we originally rated him as a receiver. Then we said athlete before we finally settled on DB. And seeing what he did at Oregon was never really a surprise to us because we saw it early. And I remember thinking, you know, after the week he had at Polynesian Bowl, and his, you know, Javon's the nicest kid, but he even said at the beginning of Polynesian Bowl week, you know, I want to make the other All-Star games regret that they didn't invite me. And then he goes out and backs it up the entire week. So he's a player that I still think, too, you know, his best football may still be ahead of him. Just a versatile defensive back that could play really, if he needed to play corner, he could. If he could play a three, he could play strong, he could play, you know, just about any spot in the secondary. And I think he's going to have a hell of a career.
Is there anybody that you were worried about that they were going to get lost in the shuffle? And it's sort of been a pleasant surprise that they were able to pop in college. You know, maybe it was, you know, injury concerns in high school. Maybe it was, you know, transferring a bunch or grades that like they just had a tough seeming road to success going from high school to college, who is now considered to be a top level talent. That just a pleasant surprise for you.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say he's so much of a surprise as the kid just wrung every ounce of ability out of his body. And again, I'm going to go back to the state of Oregon this time, but I'm going to go back to Elijah Molden. You know, Elijah Molden was a phenomenal high school football player. I mean, as good of a high school football player as you could ever imagine. I remember seeing him as a sophomore at West Lynn, going to watch him play as a running back. And, you know, he wasn't the biggest guy, wasn't necessarily the fastest kid out there. His dad's a trainer at the next facility. His dad was a former first rounder, played at Oregon, played in the NFL. But with Elijah, you know, he was a great player, but he wasn't considered one of the elite players nationally. And even if you look at the corners that were in that class out west, you know, you had Darnay Holmes, who started a couple games for the New York Giants this year. You had Jalen Johnson, who was probably the best corner in that class in terms of what he did at Utah. I think he was either late first rounder, early second rounder by the Bears. You know, you also had Diomedor Lenore at Oregon in that same class. So there were some really good DBs. Jeff Okuda, Sean Wade were also in that class. So there's a lot of good national DBs, a lot of good West Coast DBs. And I remember the thing with Elijah Molden is it was always like a three-team race in his recruitment. It was Stanford, Washington, and Oregon. And obviously, Oregon had all the family ties. Stanford, again, just like with Jalen Phillips, if you look at that Stanford class, they really reaped the benefits of that 2016 Rose Bowl win over Iowa. And I remember going to a game the night before the Oregon-Washington game when that week, Elijah had been admitted into Stanford, and Jimmy Lake was at the the Westland Tiger game. And about a week or two later, I think Elijah committed to Washington, and it was kind of a surprise. It was like, if he doesn't go to Oregon, he's going to Stanford. If he doesn't go to Stanford, he's going to Oregon. And he picked Washington, ended up really being, you know, probably their defensive MVP the last couple of years, and a guy that I think, you know, could sneak into the second round. It's not higher, but was just a phenomenal player, and a player that was a good, really, I would say a great high school player, a good prospect who just made himself that much better of a player. And again, one of the great families that you'll ever meet. I think he's one of eight kids and just the most tight-knit, closest family, just wonderful people. And then you watch Elijah Melvin on the field, and I mean, the kid is out there just destroying people. And he really just outplays kind of what his body does because he's just he works his ass off, for lack of a better term. Am I gonna say that?
Oh, you are. Of course. We're not governed by the FCC here, Brandon.
Even if it's not true, you can say it.
Final question. As I look up and down the draft board here, there are two notable cornerbacks, Patrick Surtain, Asante Samuel. I'm not so much asking a question as I am for advice. I remember both of their fathers playing in the NFL, Brandon. And I wonder, in your particular line of work, how you avoid just this perennial feeling that we're really getting old, seeing these names out there.
The intense march of time. Yeah.
It's, you know, especially when these guys that are the dads are younger than I am. You know, it's one thing when there are guys that were like my age. It's when these dads are a couple years younger than me. I'm like, wait, you know, wasn't I watching Antoine Winfield play in college when I was in college? And now I'm watching his son. You know, Fred Taylor and I were the same graduating year. And I think, you know, Kelvin, well, my oldest is a junior in high school. You know, Kelvin Taylor, I think, was 8-9 classes ago. Ray Lewis was another one that was my age. I run into that all the time now. Like, there's guys, I'm thinking, how in the world do you have a college age kid or, you know, a recruit or a kid that's going to be in the NFL? Like, I swear, weren't you just playing like 2 weeks ago? And it's fascinating. But again, that's something that, you know, it speaks to kind of a larger thing too. One thing that I would say we sometimes get lulled into, it's not so much that we're old, it's sometimes like, oh, well, he's the offspring of so-and-so. He's going to be really good. And I've told this story for years, and it's one of the biggest L's that I've ever taken. And I remember saying on a local radio station on signing day, I'm really going to regret making Nick Montana a 4-star and making Sean Mannion a 3-star. I probably should have put those two, but I didn't. And boy, did those next 4 years become prophetic to me, as Sean Mannion threw for over 10,000 yards. Nick Montana, last we saw, was throwing like 87 pick sixes for Tulane. And we're seeing it now too, where you've got a lot of legacies, a lot of guys that are the son of former NFL players, son of former NFL stars, and you think they're going to be every bit as good as their dad, who were stars, and maybe they're just average football players. They're just good, solid football players, not elite. Then you have the occasional kids where, like a Patrick Surtain, where the younger one might be better than dad.
Wow.
You know, where there are cases where the youngster is even better.
The ultimate backup is better than the starter.
Exactly. Exactly. And so that's why it's so important to ignore the name and really just dive into who the player is and what kind of player he is, and making sure that's what you're evaluating on, rather than just because they have the elite bloodline. And I think, you know, Magic Johnson and Michael Jordan's kids probably weren't that great. And now we're, you know, I don't have to do basketball rankings and having to evaluate Bronny James over the next couple of years, because I can only imagine how polarizing that's going to be. But hey, Arch Manning, we got the nephew and the son of a Manning and the grandson of a Manning, and we got 3 years of him. So we'll see if he's, you know, Eli or Peyton, or if he's, you know, Nick Montana or Jack Elway, with all due respect to Nick Montana and Jack Elway.
So I think, Ty, if what I'm hearing, if there's subtext to what Brandon is saying, is if you would like to have superstar athletes for children, it's cool if you at one point were, but maybe try to convince a strong, athletic woman to have children with you.
Yeah.
If that's, I mean, isn't Steph Curry's mom was like a terrific athlete, right? Does it, it helps. Yeah. It, if not, is the most important thing.
I mean, wasn't, who was our guy at LSU a couple years ago whose mom was OBJ? I should know that. I'm a Brown.
Track athlete, right?
Elite world-class sprinter. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes mom's the one carrying all the athleticism. Dad's just carrying the last name or, you know, if the dad's like most dads, they're taking all the credit in the world when the reality is mom really did a good job of doing everything.
That's the way it works. All right.
It's a good way to go out, Ty.
Good way to go out. Brandon Hoffman, check him out. National recruiting editor for 24/7 Sports. Also the founder and executive director of the Avery Huffman DIPG Foundation. Go and check that out at Avery Strong DIPG. Longtime friend, Brandon. Always great to have you on. We'll talk soon. All right.
Thanks, fellas. Always enjoyed talking trips down memory lane.
All right, Daniel. That is Brandon Hoffman. Again, longtime friend of the show. Always gracious with his time. You texted him mere minutes before he came on the air with us. So always willing to come on and share his insight. And we're glad he did.
The best. The absolute best. And I will say this, and I was thinking about this a couple days ago as I was reading a bunch of draft stuff, just because I'm always curious. It's not what we do. We are not draft analysts. We are not NFL people. But there's a certain amount of curiosity, I'm sure, with college football fans about how the NFL values certain players and guys that we've been fans of for a long time, where they're going to go in the draft. But the draft broadcast itself is fascinating.
Oh, I love it.
Because you think about
it. Love it.
And last year's was particularly fascinating because it was all remote. But just in terms of the number of clips that have to be available at any given moment based on who is drafted, and, you know, every analyst has to have thorough opinions and evaluations and projections for every guy that's taken, and how do they fit in with the team? What were they like in college? What are they, you know, did they change position? Like, every single minute detail has to be covered and covered quickly. So I think what we need to do is come up with some sort of fantasy things for the draft that we just love. We'll come up with a fantasy things for the draft, and you can draft your own squad of, like, you know, five things depending on, you know, when they happen, how they happen. Something I love that is absolutely going to make its way in there is the Ndamukong Suh played soccer memorial clip where it's a clearly very old clip of a prospect playing another sport
to show his athleticism.
Absolutely. To show his athleticism. Or remember there was a, I think he was a nose tackle. I forget his name. His name escapes me. At Wisconsin, there was a viral clip of him doing a backflip on the beach. Like that, the non-highlight video roles that happened during the draft. Not a lot of like improv guys. Here's this nose tackle in an improv class. But playing another sport or doing something freakishly athletic, I do live for that. Because then it kind of throws off the hosts and analysts saying like, that's pretty cool. It throws them off a little bit in their talking points. So any clip of, you know, a shot put or track and field or swimming or basketball, you know, a big one is an offensive lineman dunking.
Dunking, yeah. They got the ups.
They love that.
Yeah, the other flip side of that is the Miles Garrett Honorary Concert Pianist Award.
I think that's Joey Harrington, Ty.
Well, right. Whoever it is, you've always got the guy who can speak six languages or somebody who's really good at chess or, you know, John Urschel, who's good at math.
They make the guys fluent in other languages say something about like, welcome to the 2021 NFL draft in, you know, Farsi or Mandarin. Always good.
Well, we'll get to that. We appreciate everyone stopping on by. None more so, though, than Brandon Hoffman, our guest of honor on this here show. SolidVerbal.com is the website going out there. Yellow box is where you can put your email address. We'll start sending emails as we get a little bit closer to the year, keep you up to date with what's going on. Also, Verballers.com is a Patreon where we're posting some fun bonus stuff here throughout the offseason, Dan. That's all I got.
Same.
For that guy over there, my good friend Dan Rubenstein, for myself, Ty Hildebrandt. Thank you so much for downloading, for listening, for supporting. We will touch base again on Thursday. In the meantime, stay solid.
Peace.